Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, they've done something wonderful here at the Le Chaudhomme. They've turned the turntable sideways. That's what this place needed, because the on switch was too close to the operator. Now we're being protected from that. Just visualize it, ladies and gentlemen. You'll enjoy it. It's been a fabulous week for stuff. The House Republicans, so emboldened by their first really successful move to pass a repeal of the health care law in full knowledge, I say that that repeal will never pass the Senate or be signed by the president. So it's kind of a freebie. And as I say, they're kind of hopped up about it. The idea of repealing something without really repealing it. So they're moving forward on their agenda. I think Speaker Boehner, as soon as he stops crying, is going to announce this this week to deal with America's obesity epidemic without any new federal spending. The House will vote fairly soon to repeal the law of gravity. And that, ladies and gentlemen, will do that because, you know, we'll look the same, but we won't weigh anything. And that, imagine the end of the strain on our heart. Now, last word on the Golden Globes, at least from this corner. As long as the host is making fun of drug addicts and not of out of control drug addicted actors and not of out of control and clueless producers and studio executives, I think this show is in good hands. So congratulations to all concerned. And you may not have noticed this, but this week, President Obama has finally come around. He has announced a sweeping review of federal regulations to try to get rid of the ones that are getting in the way of business. Business. He's finally realized that if only the too big to fail banks could have erected just one more pyramid of synthetic debt, if they'd only been freed to do that, we might have avoided the economic crisis. So congratulations to all concerned. And congratulations to you because, hello, welcome to the show.
Stop when they she's there, I say, please share my umbrella. Bus stops, bus goes, she stays, love grows under my umbrella. All that summer we enjoyed it, wind and rain and shine. That umbrella we employed it, by August she was mine. Every morning see her waiting at the stop. Sometimes she'd shop and she would show me what she'd bought. All the people stared as if we were both quite insane. Someday my name and hers are going to be the same. That's the way the whole thing started, silly but it's true. Thinking of a sweet romance beginning in a queue. Came the sun, the ice was melting, no more sheltering now. Nice to think that that umbrella led me to a vow. Every morning stop. Sometimes she'd shop and she would show me what she bought. All the people stared as if we were both quite insane. Someday my name and hers are going to be the same. it's the way the whole thing started. Silly, but it's true. Thinking of a sweet romance beginning in a queue. Came the sun, the ice was melting. No more sheltering now. Nice to think that that umbrella led me to a vow.
Thank you very much. And from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this very special edition of the show. It's very special because I'm so tired. I'm so tired this week. Really. No, thank you. Flew back to New York to answer the question, have you ever been to Queens? The answer is now yes. And thanks to all the people at the Cinema Eye Honors Documentary Awards for allowing me to barge in at the fabulous new Museum of the Moving Image. It's not a moving museum. I made that mistake and drove around for about 15 minutes looking for the bus with all the screens, but it's the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens. Queens! Ray Romano runs a museum. Think of it. And then finishing up shooting the video for a song you may recall from this broadcast, Touch My Junk. Yes. And that'll be yours to shun soon. So anyway, just a guy talking today. And so much to talk about. For example, we're not number one. A couple of entries in that category this week. First, from the Wall Street Journal and the Heritage Foundation, the 2011 Index of Economic Freedom. This is what we're, you know, Obama's talking about. Why can't J.P. Morgan Chase have another $1 trillion pyramid of debt? Why aren't they free to do that? Anyway, here are the top 10 as denoted by the Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal. Listen for our name. Number 1, Hong Kong. Number 2, Singapore. Number 3, Australia. Number 4, New Zealand. Getting the picture? It's freer out west. Then, number 5, Switzerland. Number 6, Canada. Canada. Number 7, Ireland. Number 8, Denmark. Number 9, the United States. Number 10, Bahrain. Bahrain. We are number 9, ladies and gentlemen, in case anybody asks you. And from, I believe, the CIA, this is GDP, gross domestic product per capita. This is, you know, just basically how rich the average person is if income were averaged out, which last time I looked, it's not. Don't get excited. So this is, we've got to be number one on that, right? We're the richest. Number 1, Qatar. Gesundheit. Number 2, Liechtenstein. Not the artist, the country. Number 3, Luxembourg. Not the country, the little country. Number 4, Bermuda. Number 5, Singapore. Number 6, Norway. Must be the herring. Number 7, Jersey. Not New Jersey. Don't get excited, fans of Snooki. This means the little island off the coast of England. Number 8, Kuwait. At least it rhymes. Number 9, Brunei. Number 10, Faroe Islands. Something's going on here with the runaway companies and things, don't you think? And number 11, United States of America, right before Hong Kong, Andorra, and Guernsey, Jersey's sister island. We're number 11 on the list of per capita GDP. So, you know, I sometimes cast aspersions, or at least a sidelong glance at the notion of American exceptionalism. But you can now, I think, quantify or at least specify the area where we are, in fact, exceptional, ladies and gentlemen. We're the country that consistently believes we're number one while we're not. That's us. That's the good old UFN. Hey, so now news of the godly. And you're going to have to decide. So it's not really like religion. You're really going to have to decide. Because here are two contrary pieces of evidence. First, Dateline Dublin, a 1997 letter from the Vatican warned Ireland's Catholic bishops not to report all suspected child abuse cases to police. A disclosure that victims groups described as the smoking gun. Now, any guns out there, really, smoking's not even good for you. Seriously, people don't, you don't look good when you smoke. The smoking gun needed to show that the church enforced a worldwide culture of covering up crimes by pedophile priests. The newly revealed letter obtained by the Irish broadcasters RTE documents the Vatican's rejection of a 1996 Irish church initiative to begin helping police identify pedophile priests following the first wave of publicly disclosed lawsuits against the church in Ireland. But there's more to Ireland than this. The letter undermines persistent Vatican claims, particularly when seeking to defend itself in U.S. lawsuits, that Rome never instructed local bishops to withhold evidence or suspicion of crimes from police. It emphasizes the church's right to handle all child abuse allegations and determine punishments in-house rather than give that power to civil authorities. Signed by the late Archbishop Luciano Storero, Pope John Paul II's diplomat to Ireland. Hey, isn't he becoming a saint? The letter instructs Irish bishops that their new policy of making the reporting of suspected crimes mandatory, quote, gives rise to serious reservations of both a moral and canonical nature, unquote. I like saying canonical. Storero wrote that canon law, which requires abuse allegations and punishments to be handled within the church, must be meticulously followed. Any bishops who tried to impose punishments outside the confines of canon law would face, quote, the highly embarrassing position, unquote, of having their actions overturned by Rome. Catholic officials in Ireland and the Vatican declined requests from the Associated Press to comment on the letter. To this day, the Vatican has not endorsed any of the Irish Church's three major policy documents since 1996 on safeguarding children from priestly abuse. Irish taxpayers, rather than the church, have paid most of the $2 billion to more than 14,000 abuse claimants dating back to the 1940s. Taxpayers. In his 2010 pastoral letter to Ireland's Catholics condemning pedophiles, Pope Benedict faulted bishops for failing to follow canon law and offered no explicit endorsement of Irish child protection efforts by the Irish church or state. Two state commissioned reports published in 2009 unveiled decades of cover-ups of abuse involving tens of thousands of Irish children since the 1930s. A third major state-ordered investigation into Catholic abuse cover-ups concerning the Southwest Irish Diocese of Cloyne. The Diocese of Cloyne, ladies and gentlemen, is expected to be published in the next few months, documenting its concealment of crimes as recently as 2008. Down in Cloyne. Irish church leaders didn't begin telling police about suspected pedophile priests until the mid-1990s, after the first major scandal triggered the collapse of the Irish government. That shock inspired the first victims to begin suing the church publicly. Storero, going back to him, decided the Irish church policy of mandatory reporting of abuse claims conflicted with canon law. He emphasized in the letter the Irish church's policy was not recognized by the Vatican and was merely a study document. Storero warned that bishops who followed the Irish child protection policy and reported a priest's suspected crimes to the police risked having their in-house punishments of the priest overturned by the Congregation for the Clergy. This actually happened in one case. One of Dublin's most notorious pedophiles, who used his role as an Elvis impersonator in a popular all-priests show to get closer to kids. He was kicked out of the priesthood by a secret Dublin church court in 1993, successfully appealed the punishment to a Vatican court, which reinstated him to the priesthood in 1994 and gave him back his Elvis suit. No. He then assaulted a boy in a pub restroom at his grandfather's wake. Ladies and gentlemen, he has now received a series of prison sentences, most recently a 12-year term imposed last month. He molested more than 100 children. Stordero's letter was obtained by the Irish Television Religious Affairs Program. This is the real name of it, ladies and gentlemen. Would you believe? Today, the Vatican's child protection policies remain in legal limbo, which is a fun dance to do, legal limbo. Now, believe that or believe this. The Vatican moved into damage limitation mode in relation to the controversial comments by Archbishop Storero. The Vatican, late in the week, insisted it was in no way urging that the law of the land should not be respected. Claiming that the letter had been misinterpreted, the Holy See argued it did not contain an instruction to bishops urging them not to report priests to the relevant civil authorities. In particular, the situation of mandatory reporting gives rise to serious reservations of both the moral or canonical nature, wrote Dr. Storaro. But Vatican spokesman Father Federico Lombardi said the letter had been misinterpreted. It must be pointed out, he says, that the letter in no way indicates that the law of the land should not be adhered to. However, the letter also insists on the importance of always respecting canon law in order to avoid situations where guilty parties might not find a cause for appeal and therefore obtain the opposite result to that desired. He argued that the reservations about mandatory reporting referred to in the letter concerned the impact that such reporting might have on any subsequent canonical proceeding. Even in cloyne. Just to say canonical in cloyne over and over again, ladies and gentlemen, is reason enough for me to have an hour on the radio. And another Vatican letter instructing non-cooperation with civil authorities has come to light. This one from 1984, addressed to the Bishop of Tucson, Arizona, coincidentally enough. The 1984 Vatican letter, released by bishopaccountability.org, is less vague in its wording than the 1997 letter from Storero. John Paul II, hey, isn't he going to become a saint? Was also the Pope in 1984 when this letter was written. This letter was written by Silvio Angelo Pio, Cardinal Oddi, who was the prefect of the Vatican's Congregation of the Clergy, that is, the Curia, which, together with the Pope, is the governing body of the Church. And it's addressed to the Bishop of Tucson, Bishop Moreno. It was written in response to Moreno's request for guidance on how to proceed regarding a badly behaving priest. After telling Bishop Moreno that there was not any need for engaging in the so-called due process procedures, Cardinal Oddi answers Moreno's question, should we allow or disallow civil lawyers from obtaining Father's personal records from our files? Answer, quote, under no condition whatever ought the aforementioned files be surrendered to any lawyer or judge whatsoever. The files of a bishop concerning his priests are altogether private. Their forced acquisition by civil authority would be an intolerable attack upon the free exercise of religion in the United States. This written by an Italian. The cardinal goes on to say that Moreno should, quote, make known immediately and with clarity that no priest's files will be sent to any lawyer or judge whatever. He continues, we should be clear and resolute, for failure in this regard might initiate a movement toward a most unfavorable precedent in law, and no less importantly, frighten and upset not a few priests whose files are perhaps less than flattering. Unquote, Cardinal Oddi. The priest in the matter that occasioned the letter was not, as it happened, accused of sexual abuse. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
Yes. Yes, it is news of our friend the Atom. The uranium market, the uranium market, I should say, is bullish again. Ladies and gentlemen, this deals with the question of how cheap this is all going to be. The uranium market has been set afire by China's quest to secure nuclear fuel. After watching the price of the metal crater for much of the past 3 years, investors are once again optimistic. Uranium is in a new bull market, says a portfolio manager for Middlefield Capital. The price has moved from $40 a pound to over $62, says this manager. I think in the next 2 years it will settle in the $75 range. 5 years from now, we can see $80 to $100 a pound uranium. Market watchers see higher uranium prices ahead because of tightening supply and rising demand, particularly from China and other emerging markets. Barring a major nuclear accident, how could that possibly fail? Demand is expected to remain buoyant as developed countries embrace nuclear power as a clean fuel. Ask them where they're going to store the waste. In developing countries. China signed three long-term contracts to buy a total of 140 million pounds of uranium from France and Kazakhstan in November. China was tying up a large chunk of world supply between now and 2020, says a commodity specialist. What will happen is that utilities in other countries are going to be keen to tie up new supply as well. As much as 80% of current world uranium production has already been sold to utilities under long-term contracts. Meanwhile, demand is expanding. Cheap? Safe? Oh, Dateline Brattleboro, Vermont. This is deja vu all over again, all over again, all over again. Both the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Vermont Department of Health have indicated there may be a new, this would be a new leak of tritium irradiated water at the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. It doesn't appear to have any connection to the original leakage from last year, said a spokesman for the NRC. It's evident that either groundwater can follow the human-made channels or it's another system or components that are leaking, says the chief of radiological health for Vermont Department of Health. Both said the level of tritium in the groundwater, 9,200 picocuries per liter. Did we go metric overnight? Poses no danger to public health. The first tritium leak was found in January of 2010. The source of that leak was identified and stopped in March. So it's at least consistent. The Vermont Yankee plant may or may not be kept up to snuff in terms of maintenance, but it can continue to produce tritium leaks. We have a reading we don't understand. We're investigating to see what it means, says the spokesperson for Yankee plant. Clean, safe, too cheap to meter. Ladies and gentlemen, it's our friend the Atom. Bye, Eddie.
Bye-bye.
He's so cute. He doesn't slam the door when he leaves either. And ladies and gentlemen, now, the new F-bomb. Foreclosure. Somewhere, perhaps in Georgia, lives a woman named Linda Green, speculates the Palm Beach Post. According to investigators, her signature and variations of it appear on hundreds of thousands of questionable mortgage documents. We discussed this with Eve Smith on this broadcast back in December. Linda Green has been a vice president of at least 14 banks and mortgage companies, according to her identification on mortgage documents she signed, including Wells Fargo and Bank of America. By signing, she attests to the true owner of a mortgage, which proves that a bank has the right to foreclose on a home. One of those homes belongs to Lynn Szymaniak, a Palm Beach lawyer who specializes in white-collar crime. 61-year-old Szymaniak has ferreted out economic crimes for years. After negotiations with her lender over an increase to an adjustable rate mortgage failed, she got a foreclosure notice, which she saw made no sense. The company servicing her mortgage was in Dallas. Linda Green was in Alpharetta, Georgia. Szymaniak launched an investigation of her own foreclosures. Linda Green's signature varied widely in the thousands of documents Szymaniak found. She'd uncovered the practice of robo-signing employees at banks and mortgage servicing companies who signed sworn affidavits without any knowledge of the case. Linda Green is believed to be among the most common robo-signatures of them all. I have had training in this, but you don't need training, says Szymaniak. It's obvious to anyone that many people are Linda Green. Lender Process Services Incorporated has confirmed that Green worked for its defunct subsidiary, DocX, which used to advertise when it was funked, that it would create new mortgage assignment documents in cases where they were missing. You know, just create them. She does not now work for Lender Process Services, they say. The Florida Attorney General's office is investigating LPS in connection with documents that, quote, appear to be forged, incorrectly and illegally executed, and false and misleading. Aside from that, perfectly good. Often Green's mortgage assignment was dated months after the case was filed, bringing into question the true owner of the note when the proceedings began. Another document in Sismoniac's case was a copy of what appeared to be the top of her mortgage, pasted to the bottom of another document. By the way, I think it was reported this week that we have passed the 1 million mark in home foreclosures. Since 2008, the Florida Attorney General's office has launched more than 150 mortgage fraud investigations. 50 companies are under review. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, coming your way. But now, on the brighter side. News of the Olympic movement. London's 853 million dollar Olympic stadium may be torn down right after the 2012 games. Torn down. That's according to plans being submitted this week by one of two bidders hoping to take possession of the site after the games. Soccer teams Tottenham Hotspur and West Ham both want to have anchor tenant status at the venue. A decision will be made in March on plans for the facility, which will host the opening ceremony and the track events of the Olympics. Tottenham, based in North London since 1882, and its partner Anschutz Entertainment Group, owners of Staples Center, are proposing to rip down the Olympic Stadium for a new soccer-specific facility. That means it would function as a track and field facility for just 30 days. On the other hand, West Ham promises to maintain much of the current stadium, including the running track. Opponents to Tottenham's bid say allowing the club to raise the site would be a waste of money, like $500 million, and hurt the UK's credibility as a sporting nation. Its bid centered on leaving an athletics legacy, that is to say, a track and field legacy, at Olympic Park. We're just about to renege on the biggest international promise in sport that we've ever made, says Alan Pascoe, vice chairman of London's bid team. We can just dispense with £500 million of taxpayer investment. Tottenham is proposing the renovation of a stadium in South London to meet the bid team's promise to the IOC to create a permanent 25,000-seat venue that can be used for track and field. That would be a totally different place from Olympic Park. I've always had concerns and doubts about the whole stadium legacy issue, said Mike Lee, who helped prepare London's winning bid for 2012 and is now an advisor to Tottenham. We know what works in this country in terms of atmosphere and the fan experience. What would track and field do with a 60,000-seat venue? Soccer teams are getting away from multi-use stadiums because of fans' complaints about distance to the action and players' concerns that facilities lack atmosphere. $500 million down the toilet? You be the judge. or at least be the spectators. The Olympics. It's a movement. And everybody needs one. Every day! This is Le Show. And ladies and gentlemen, on the twin subjects of is there any news in the WikiLeaks State Department cable disclosures? And are they affecting U.S. relationships, diplomatic relationships with other countries? Some items of interest. First, from the Washington Times, FBI agents thought they were hunting a spy for Israel in 2004. When they raided the offices of a top lobbyist for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, according to a search warrant affidavit obtained by the Times, the document still under court seal provides an extraordinary look at what the agents considered to be espionage activity in a nearly five-year counterintelligence probe of one of the Israel lobby's top officials. It also shows that the everyday activities of diplomats, lobbyists, and reporters, meeting with U.S. officials, taking notes, and then trading that information with other officials, was considered spying by the FBI. The AIPAC investigation, says the Washington Times, has had a lasting effect on U.S.-Israel relations. The FBI blocked Israel's current national security advisor from entering the United States between 2007 and 2009 on grounds he'd met with a secondary target of the probe. So that probe has affected U.S. diplomatic relations. But what about WikiLeaks? Well, internal U.S. government reviews have determined that mass leak of diplomatic cables has caused limited damage to U.S. interests abroad, despite the administration's statements to the contrary. This is the Obama administration, ladies and gentlemen. A congressional official briefed on the reviews said, told Mark Hosenball at Reuters that the administration felt compelled to say publicly that the revelations had seriously damaged America's interests in order to bolster the legal efforts to shut down the WikiLeaks website and bring charges against the leakers. State Department officials have privately told Congress they expect overall damage to U.S. foreign policy to be containable, said the official, one of two congressional aides familiar with the briefings who spoke to Reuters. We were told the impact of the WikiLeaks revelation was embarrassing but not damaging, said the official. Embarrassing but not damaging. National security officials familiar with the damage assessments being conducted by defense and intelligence agencies told Reuters the reviews so far have shown pockets of short-term damage, some of it potentially harmful. Long-term damage to U.S. defense and intelligence operations, they said, is unlikely to be serious. Some of the cases of possible damage have occurred in countries where WikiLeaks revelations have publicized closer ties with Washington than local officials care to publicly admit, such as Yemen. And now to the other contention that there is no news in the WikiLeaks cables, we go to news from outside the bubble. A confidential cable reports a meeting with then-Irish Foreign Minister Dermot O'Hearn, this is in 2010, and relates approvingly his tamping down of public reaction to a report by the Irish Human Rights Commission on extraordinary rendition. That report had demanded the Irish government inspect flights at Shannon Airport, going through Shannon Airport, to ensure that extraordinary rendition was not occurring, a demand that the Irish foreign minister had unequivocally rejected. That move drew the censure of the European Parliament. This cable reveals that Hearn had assured the public that rendition was not occurring. Rendition is when the U.S. sent detainees abroad for interrogation in countries friendlier to torture even than us. But while he said that in public, O'Hearn was apparently reasonably certain that several renditions had in fact occurred. O'Hearn requested of the U.S. ambassador a token inspection agreement, i.e. a sham inspection agreement, so as to provide political cover, lest the actual renditions become public knowledge. That's newsworthy, if you're Irish. The Guardian reports Turkey allowed the U.S. to use its airbase at Incirlik in southern Turkey as part of extraordinary renditions to take suspected terrorists to Guantanamo Bay, according to WikiLeaks. Turkey's involvement was revealed in a cable dated June 8, 2006, written by the then ambassador to Turkey, Ross Wilson. Turkey military had allowed us to use Incirlik as a refueling stop for, here's the name of the extraordinary rendition flights. You'll like this. Operation Fundamental Justice. Detainee movement operations. But they revoked this permission in February of 2006. We understand that Office of Secretary of Defense has been discussing whether to approach Turkey to seek to reverse this decision. We recommend you do not raise this issue with Turkish General Staff pending clarification from Washington on what approach National Security Council wish to take. This cable contradicts statements made at the time by Turkish officials. The Turkish government and state never played a part in the secret transfers and never will, said a spokesman for Turkey and their military. They lie. Well, they misspeak. But who doesn't? Turkey had just been named in a Council of Europe report among 14 European countries that colluded in or tolerated the covert transporting of prisoners. And there's more. Also from outside the bubble, a letter addressed to the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Amos. I'll pause for the obvious joke. Dear General Amos, as a former regular Marine Corps captain, a Korean War combat veteran now retired on VA disability due to wounds suffered during that conflict, I write you to protest and express concern about the confinement in the Quantico Marine Corps base brig of U.S. Army PFC Bradley Manning. Parenthetically, Manning is the Army private alleged, though not yet charged, with leaking the State Department cables to WikiLeaks. The letter continues, Manning, if the information I have is correct, is charged with having violated provisions of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. This seems straightforward enough and sufficient to have Manning court-martialed and if found guilty sentenced in accordance with the UCMJ. What concerns me here is the manner in which the legal action against him is being conducted. I wonder in the first place why an Army enlisted man is being held in a Marine Corps installation. Second, I question the length of confinement prior to conduct of court-martial. The Sixth Amendment, guaranteeing to all the right to a speedy and public trial, extends to those being prosecuted in the military justice system. Third, I seriously doubt that the conditions of his confinement, solitary, sleep interruption, denial of all but minimal physical exercise, are necessary, customary, or in accordance with law, U.S. or international. I have to wonder why the Marine Corps has put itself or allowed itself to be put in this invidious and ambiguous situation. The conditions of his confinement in the Quantico Brig are very clearly under your review. If I may say so, these bring little credit either to you or your subordinates at Marine Corps base. The author of the letter, David C. McMichael, was formerly commander at Marine Corps base at Quantico. From the Independent in London, a new generation of pesticides is making honeybees far more susceptible to disease, even in tiny doses, and may be a clue to the mysterious colony collapse disorder that's been devastating bees across the world. That, according to the U.S. government's leading bee researcher, the discovery has remained unpublished for nearly 2 years since it was made by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Bee Research Laboratory. The release of such a finding from the American government's own bee lab would put a major question mark over the use of neonicotinoid insecticides, relatively new compounds which mimic the insect-killing properties of nicotine, and which are increasingly used on crops in the U.S., Britain, and around the world. Bayer, the German chemicals giant which developed the insecticides, insists they are safe for bees if used properly. But they already have been widely linked to bee mortality. Apparently the bees don't know how to use it. And finally, once more, on the subject of detention, torture, from the Australian, owned by Rupert Murdoch, the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security in Australia has ordered a fresh inquiry into the case of former Gitmo detainee Mamdou Habib. The Australian Prime Minister has requested the new probe amid dramatic claims of Australian government complicity in his 2001 CIA rendition to Egypt, where he was detained and tortured. The investigation follows a secret compensation payout made by the Australian government to Habib last month, apparently triggered by untested witness statements implicating Australian officials in his detention and brutal maltreatment in a Cairo military prison. The new evidence, not previously made public, includes a statement from a former Egyptian military intelligence officer that he was present when Habib was transferred to Cairo. In the statement, the officer says Australian officials were present when Habib arrived in Egypt, handcuffed, feet bound, naked, and drugged. During Habib's presence, some of the Australian officials attended interrogations many times. Habib was tortured a lot and all the time as the foreign intelligence wanted quick and fast information, unquote. Didn't say they wanted accurate information. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is the show still. Yeah, it persists. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of most of the Afghan Taliban frontier leadership has reportedly been sheltered in Karachi. That's in Pakistan, under a Pakistani security establishment's secret program, according to an Indian newspaper report. The whole notion that most of the Taliban leadership was stationed in Quetta, another Pakistani city, was a proxy. In reality, it's Karachi. This is quoting a top NATO source. The Taliban are known to have moved elements of their command to Karachi to avoid potential U.S. targeting and predator airstrikes. Even elusive Afghan Taliban leader Mullah Omar is thought to be in a safe house in Karachi under the protection of Pakistani intelligence. You liking this yet? You could dig in this? It's a cool scene, isn't it? Speaking of Pakistan, the government has decided to drop the phrase frontline state in war against terrorism, frequently used by its officials to highlight Pakistan's role against terror. The phrase is not serving the country's interest, an official says. Descriptions like frontline state in war against terrorism overcast the country's positivities. Therefore, we are doing away with the phrase. The Pakistani newspaper Dawn quoted a senior Pakistani security official as saying. He said the frontline phrase was misleading as it created an impression that the problem of terrorism was specific to that region. And it contradicts Pakistan's position that it's a global phenomenon. We don't want to be seen as the epicenter of terrorism anymore, he said. Pakistan acquired the tag soon after the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Although we kept being told it was Iraq, didn't we? Did I dream that? Oh, hey, speaking of which, a couple of things to trigger the memory bank. This week was the 50th anniversary of the farewell speech of President Dwight David Eisenhower. I'm sure, heard reference to his warning against the military-industrial complex. But here it is.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Thanks for the warning, sir. We ignored it. P.S. More news of AFPAC. Afghan President Hamid Karzai ordered a one-month delay in the seating in the new parliament. That's democratic, isn't it? The parliament was elected in September. This further prolongs the nation's political turmoil. His decision follows a recommendation of a special court he appointed to investigate electoral fraud. Leaves the nation without a critical check on executive power. Karzai rules by decree in the interim. It is raising the possibility that Karzai's government is looking for ways to change the election's results, which went against many of his supporters. Don't you know? And this week, British Prime Minister Tony Blair made his second annual appearance in front of the Chilcot inquiry into the origins and conduct of the Iraq War in the United Kingdom. Yes, they have inquiries into the Iraq War in the United Kingdom. Quaint, wouldn't you say? It's like a royal wedding. It's a, you know, It's a hangover. It's vestigial. And during his final bit of his testimony on Friday, he, maybe you knew this, maybe you didn't. Here's a question and answer of Tony Blair at the Iraq Inquiry.
Was the effect of the action that we took in Iraq, at least with regard to the nuclear proliferation in Iran, the reverse of what we'd intended? Is that how it's actually turned out?
No, I don't think so.
You mean it's deterred Iran?
No, but I want to make this point very clearly. The single thing that is said most often to me in the Middle East by people who opposed what I did was nothing to do with it was a bad idea to get rid of Saddam. They are well rid of him and believe that. They say you've made Iran more powerful by getting rid of Saddam. And my answer to that is very simple, and it's fundamental to this whole question. The answer to Iran is not Saddam. That was our policy back in the 1980s. And all we did was then create a monster we couldn't control.
We created a monster we couldn't control. Thank goodness we didn't make that mistake with Al-Qaeda. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. No direct relation.
We're so sorry.
The U.S. lacrosse team has apologized to fans outraged by a halftime show that involved scantily clad female dancers giving a lap dance to the team mascot. Doug Refew, the president and general manager for the Boston Blazers, said the team was extremely disappointed by parts of the performance. Some spectators complained, saying it was not appropriate for family viewing. While the women danced in front of the mascot, known as Scorch, the video shows the announcer shouting, "What do you think?" Dateline Laguna Beach, Thalia Surf Shop has taken down its online Martin Luther King Day promotion and apologized for any offense the sale may have caused. An ad on the shop's website announced 20% off black-colored products like wetsuits and T-shirts in honor of King. The ad, titled Respect, featured a digitally altered image of Dr. King in a wetsuit holding a surfboard. Owner Nick Kokoris posted an apology on the shop's blog. The Democratic congressman who invoked the Nazis and Holocaust in a speech about GOP attempts to repeal the health care law has apologized. Representative Steve Cohen, Democrat of Tennessee, expressed regret that anyone in the Jewish community, my Republican colleagues, or anyone else was offended by the portrayal of my comments. Dateline Manila, controversial actor Baron Geisler apologized to actress Cherry Pie Picotch for allegedly touching her breasts this week. "I would like to apologize to Miss Pie," he says. "If I touched her or grabbed her in any way she felt violated or offended, I'm very sorry. Miss Pie, I was just doing my job. I had no intention to put you in that position or make you feel that way." Cherry Pie filed a complaint against him before television network management. She accused him of touching her breast during the taping of the television series Noah. The chief executive of Groupon, the rapidly growing online coupon provider, apologized to Japanese customers for a New Year's deal gone wrong. Kauai County officials apologized for a major mistake in a weather warning. Thousands of people accidentally received an automated test message on Sunday that said, "This is your Kauai civil defense. The sky is falling." And one of the men wounded in the mass shooting in Tucson apologized for an outburst at a town hall meeting. James Eric Fuller apologized through his girlfriend for his misplaced outrage. The apology... Oh, and the BBC apologized to Japanese viewers over jokes about a man who survived both atomic bombs dropped on the country during World War II following complaints from the Japanese embassy. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I'm sorry, Ike. We didn't mean to ignore your warning. It's just that we weren't paying attention. Ladies and gentlemen, the Big Uneasy begins its march through America. Well, it begins really in earnest in March. But it begins in Louisiana on January 30th, a week from today, at the Cinema on the Bayou Film Festival. That's at 4 p.m. at the James Devon Monkus Performing Arts Theater in Lafayette, Louisiana. That's closing night of the festival, and I will be there. That concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com are the two locations available. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And be just like rendition becoming ordinary, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, not in exile anymore, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to Pam Halstead. The show is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless with the Golden Voice.